Welcome to the Marketplace, No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow from WUNC and the Rialto Theater here in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Tess Vigeland. You know, elections are about a lot of things, but they come down to this: numbers. So, Kai?
Yes?
Let's do the numbers.
Let's do that. We have, thankfully, a scant eight days left until this election. Your state, North Carolina, is what I think they call, a swing state, right? Must be nice. All those ads telling you what you need to know in the most truthful, direct, not at all controversial way.
Right. And in fact, Kai, get this. Political ad spending in North Carolina has increased by more than 195%. That's compared to 2008. Total of nearly $70 million spent here.
And since we're keeping score, and we are, of course, you rank fifth in that category compared to other states. A lot of the money being spent on ads here, by the way, comes from outside groups. Those super PACs with names that sound something like a workout video, right? Restore Our Future, Joe Six PACs, you get it? Priorities USA, Feel the Heat, just to name a couple.
So what does this all mean for you? Well, we're going to explain the economics behind getting your vote and what issues you should be paying attention to when you hear these familiar voices.
We can choose a future where we export more products and outsource fewer jobs. After a decade that was defined by what we bought and borrowed, we're getting back to basics and doing what America's always done best. We are making things again.
That America, that united America, can unleash an economy that will put Americans back to work, that will once again lead the world with innovation and productivity, and that will restore every father and mother's confidence that their children's future is brighter even than the past.
Governor Romney and President Obama, of course. You know, elections usually have a theme, don't they? National security, foreign affairs. This time around, it's the economy, jobs and taxes, the deficit, the middle class as well.
Hey, and Kai, here in North Carolina, those issues are really front and center. The unemployment rate here is 9.6%, and that's almost 2 percentage points higher than the national average. But what's even more important is the story behind those numbers. And that is why we are here today, taking the time to explain, I think, what often gets kind of passed along as a bunch of talking points.
Absolutely. So here's the deal. This election is about so many things that are so much more important than who's ahead in which poll and by how much. It's not the horse race that matters. It is, repeat after me, the economy. Stupid. But what does that... I know, you've never heard that before, right? But what does that even mean? So, tonight, some music, some stories... Live music from David Gurr, by the way. Stories, interviews, the Marketplace, No Horse, No Race, Election Roadshow. Stick around. Pick your favorite. What do you like, right or left? It's up to you. Pick your favorite.
All right, so I have been here less than 18 hours at this point, and I got to tell you, I am already sick of all the political ads I'm seeing on television.
But here's the thing,
stop.
Right? We live in... All right, fine. You guys take that. You know what, though? You don't know what it's like not to be wanted. I live in California. Tess lives in California. We don't know political presidential ads from nothing. It makes me feel wanted.
You feel really sorry for us. Yeah, now,
I know, right? But they do remind me that this election is an election that's right up our alley. It is, of course, the economy.
So how is that playing out here? As we mentioned earlier, unemployment here in North Carolina is 2 points higher than the national average at about 9.6%.
Here in the Research Triangle, though, job creation, household income, those are election buzzwords, and they are on the rise. They're going up. So our first guest tonight, Patrick Conway, has some insights about all that. He's an economist at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Welcome to the broadcast. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you. Really
good
to have you.
So talk to us first about what is driving this growth here in the Raleigh, the Research Triangle area.
I think you could say that the growth in the Research Triangle area is fueled in large part by, well, first of all, we have the state government here, and that has been growing. But also we have the Research Triangle Park, which is an area of the state defined by the universities, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, North Carolina State University, and Duke University at the three corners. Mm-hmm. And in between we have the Research Triangle Park, which is a high-tech research and manufacturing center.
David Gurr is going to come up. He has a son in North Carolina. He's going to be here in about 2 or 3 minutes, maybe a little more. And he's going to tell us about the two North Carolinas, right? The old economy and the new economy. Give us the primer. Give us the Economist 45-second version of how that happened.
Well, we've got, you could say there's the...
45 seconds, by the way. Ready?
We've got triangle jobs. We've got outside the triangle jobs.
Right.
The outside the triangle jobs come mainly, we could think of it as the ghost of manufacturing past. We had large numbers of light manufacturing jobs. They were did not require great skills, but rather training. And so people would leave their high schools, even before getting a high school degree, and would go to work at the plant.
Huh.
Those people, when they found that the manufacturing jobs were disappearing, did not have the skills necessary to turn around to another job. And so we have two job markets, really. The triangle job market, where there are relatively high-skilled, highly educated people. And then we've got the outside the triangle job markets, those in which the education is lower, the skills are more specific to the jobs that people used to have, but perhaps are not the right ones for the jobs that are coming out now.
We're going to be talking about the election and early voting in just a second with some a different panel, but I want to get to the no horse, no race part of this. When people vote in this state, and early voting has been going on here for a little bit, are people voting on the economy?
My expectation it is. I think jobs is the issue here, just as it is elsewhere. You did the numbers for us. The unemployment rate is well above the national average. And it's not the same across all counties. Orange County, where I come from, it's down at about 6%.
Mm-hmm.
But in Lenoir County, just a bit to the east of us, over 10%.
Oof.
Rutherford County to the west, 14%.
Patrick Conway from the UNC Chapel Hill.
Thank you
for your time.
Thank you.
All right, so we heard Patrick Conway from UNC talking about the two North Carolinas. One, agricultural, old-time manufacturing, furniture, textiles. The other, centered around cities like Raleigh in this general area, as we heard. Airports, universities, all of that stuff.
And David Gurra is our reporter in Washington, D.C. So good to see you. We don't get to see
you very
often.
Absolutely good to see you.
You're on the East Coast. He has been on the road a lot this year, is that fair to say? Focusing on what we've been calling the real economy. He's been to, Nebraska, Florida?
Georgia, New York, and here,
North Carolina. All right. And as a matter of fact, you talked to our friend Professor Conway before you came down here from D.C., and, you know, we talked about this notion of the two Carolinas as the framework for your reporting trip. And so you are going to tell us a little bit about your travels, right?
Absolutely. So this was the road trip that I never got to take growing up here. I think I put 1,000 miles on the car, and it's always good to have an excuse to come back here. One thing I wasn't able to do when I was here, though, was play some music.
All right.
I grew up playing the fiddle, so if you'll indulge me.
Go to town.
One, two. I brought back up here.
Absolutely.
Joe Newbery and Jim Watson, we're going to play a Marketplace-y tune.
You guys hit it.
And it's not just...
He does more than just radio.
Yeah. And it's not just Marketplace. He has a North Carolina connection. This is a tune that Charlie Poole played. Charlie Poole and his North Carolina Rambler. So. It's called Bill Morgan and His Gal, or... My name is Morgan, but it ain't JP.
Well, a man named William Morgan took his girl to see a play. On their journey homeward, they stopped into a cafe. As soon as they were seated, Liza grabbed a bill of fare. When the waiter returned, she ordered, everything was there. Bill says, I know you're hungry, dear, I'm not one to squeal, but who do you suppose is gonna pay for such a meal? You may have known me pretty long, you sure have got my initials wrong. My name is Morgan, but it ain't JP. My name is Morgan, but it ain't JP. There is no bank on Wall Street that belongs to me. You may have known me pretty long, but you sure have got my initials wrong. My name is Morgan, but it ain't JP.
Come on, David Gura.
Yeah, buddy. More than just radio. He does more than just radio.
Come on, he's a hometown boy. That's right.
Bill Morgan married Liza, thinking she would change her ways. What she did to William next, I'm most ashamed to say. When she'd go out shopping, she'd buy everything she'd see. What she couldn't pay for, had it sent home COD. One day, six big delivery wagons are backed up to Bill's door. They asked him to accept the goods while they went back for more. It did not take Bill very long to grab his hat and coat. When Liza returned again, she found this little note. It read, my name is Morgan, but it ain't J.P. You must think I own a railroad company. You may have known me pretty long, but you sure have got my initials wrong. My name is Morgan, but it ain't J.P. My name is Morgan, but it ain't J.P. There are no Texas oil wells that belong to me. You may have known me pretty long, but you sure have got my initials wrong. My name is Morgan, but it ain't J.P.
There you go. How about
all
that?
Right.
How about that? Thank you, sir. They'll be back. Tell you what, Garrison Keillor's got nothing on us. Right? Come on. How about that?
All right, so David, you're a Tar Heel. You grew
up
here.
So
what was it like just reporting here?
Yeah, I wanted to check out the other part of the state, the part outside of the Triangle, and so I'm going to talk about two places I went to in particular. The first was Lenore, out in the western part of the state,
yep.
And this was, as the professor was saying, a place where there was a lot of light manufacturing, a lot of furniture making, and, mm-hmm. and that disappeared really over the last 10 or 15 years, and I think it's hard to underestimate how important that was to that part of the state, and I talked to Deborah Murray. She's the head of economic development for that county in the state, and this is what she said.
Furniture had made us very secure for a lot of generations since before the turn of the century. And it was a good, honest wage, and it was a good, safe thing to do, and it was what you did here.
And she said that when that industry left the town, it left the community reeling. And I just wanted to go over sort of the unemployment levels over these last couple of years. In 2002... unemployment there was just around 2%. She said in 2008 it got up to 8.3%. In 2010 it was just below 17.5%.
17.
Wow.
And now it's hovering around 11. But yeah, the community is still reeling. As she said.
Unemployment numbers on Friday, by the way, so look out for those. Reeling. What are they doing today? What is that?
So it was super interesting to go to this town because you've got people who are very optimistic. They want these jobs to come back. You talk about election issues. That's something they're talking about a lot. But it's also clear that in these communities, they're also very desperate for there to be new jobs. And in Lenore, a couple of years back, I remember reading about this when I was here, Google was considering building a data farm in this community.
Wow.
I thought that was crazy, a data farm in Lenore, North Carolina. The community really bent over backwards to get Google to come there, and they offered what were pretty extreme incentives for them to do that. I have them here. Exempt from paying 100% of personal property tax for the next 30 years, and exempt from paying 80% of real property for the next 30 years. So this is a pretty big chunk, and I spoke to a town councilman who voted against that. His name was T.J. Rohr, and he said that if he wasn't on the town council, if he didn't know what they were building, this is what he would have thought.
I'd have thought, Google, look at the size of that place. They had a grand opening, I think, in May 2007 and invited folks in, provided all sorts of transportation to be there. I would have thought, wow, this is going to be great. It's going to be a new furniture industry. They're going to hire hundreds of people, be running 24 hours a day, shifts of several hundred people.
It's really not what it is.
Yeah.
It's a giant facility, and if it were a furniture factory, it would be employing hundreds and hundreds of people. Google is very secretive about how many it's employing, but it's something the community is really upset about is that Google has not hired as many locals as they thought they would, and so this community is sort of thinking, oh, we bent over backwards for this company. What are we getting out of it?
I know that you went to another county, Scotland County, south of here, near the border. Why did you go there?
Yeah, I looked at a map of sort of what unemployment was like in the state, and this was a county that really stood out. It had the highest unemployment in the state, and it's been that way for years, really 4 or 5 years. Right now it's at 17.2%. That's a little southwest of here. I got to Laurinburg, which is the county seat. I started walking around, and I talked to Ray McDaniel. He owns a florist there.
It creates a problem where people don't want to move here. They'll say, you know, you're the highest county tax, you're the highest city tax. What's in the county? What makes us want to come there? There's nothing there to offer us, which is true. There's nothing here. We have a lot of unemployment. We have a lot of homes that are foreclosed on. We have a lot of people moving out of the area. There are a lot of houses that people are just walking away from. They just can't afford the payments.
It's interesting because a lot of people here, I think, are shocked at some of those unemployment numbers, right? Yeah. There were some gasps from the audience. David Gura from our Marketplace Washington Bureau. David, thanks a lot.
Very nice.
Tell you what. He and the boys are going to play us one more on the way out of here. David, take it, man. Best part of the show so far, right? I know.
Once I had fortune, I locked it in a trunk. I lost it all in a gambling game one night when I got drunk. Fortune I had it, fortune I lost it, fortune I lost it one night when I got drunk. Oh, once I had a fortune, then I lost it all. I lost it with a deck of cards coming from the ball. Fortune I had it, fortune I lost it, fortune I lost it one night when I got drunk.
Go.
All right.
How about that? Hey, you did great. They're going to be back one more time before we get them out of here.
You're listening to the Marketplace No Horse, No Race Road Show on North Carolina Public Radio. It was recorded by WUNC last night at the Rialto Theater in Raleigh. There's more election coverage from North Carolina Public Radio online at WUNC.org.
This is the Marketplace No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow. All right, so I don't know if you know this. You probably don't, but you live, work, and play in America's best city. Did you know that?
What? Wait, hold it. Somebody over there didn't know that. She actually gasped. You know where you are, right? I mean,
seems like every magazine out there thinks that you are absolutely the cat's meow. And so you are probably also not surprised to know that Raleigh is America's most optimistic large metro area, the hottest spot for tech jobs, and the healthiest city in the nation for women.
Nancy McFarlane is the mayor of Raleigh. Madam Mayor, thank you so much for being here. Really
thank
appreciate
you very
coming.
Much. Happy to be here.
So here's the first question, and it's a softball. What makes Raleigh so great? I mean, come on, it's a city.
I don't know. It's a pretty long list. How much time do we have?
You have a four-minute segment. Ready to begin.
Okay. You know, it's a combination of things. It's the people. That's really what makes it great. But
there you go.
It's, you know, we do have the universities. You've got great climate. We've got great parks and rec. We've got great art scene. We've got, you know, incredible diversity of businesses here. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of things go into it.
How's the economic vibe? I mean, you know, we've heard the numbers, but what does it feel like? Is there a buzz?
Well, you know, I think that one thing was really interesting listening to the discussion about the two North Carolinas. Yeah. You know, we are very fortunate here. Our unemployment rate is much lower than the state, and we really do, with the universities here, the colleges, the incredibly great community college system, that's really a huge boost to us. We also have a great diversity. When you talked about one county that suffered so much with the loss of the furniture manufacturing, yeah. I mean, we do not have a huge concentration in any one thing, so that really helps protect us too.
You know, I'm always curious, in a swing state, much attention is paid to you. And I know President Obama was here and I think went visited a cupcake shop and Governor Romney went to a barbecue joint. Does that actually do anything for your local economy when you are such a focus of the campaigns?
You know, can't say that the visit to the cupcake shop was a huge
what is it
motivator,
with cupcakes
but,
anyway? Jesus.
You know, I have to say, what it does do is it does bring attention to the area,
right.
to the media nationally. And it's kind of interesting sometimes the follow-up calls and inquiries we get about, you know, we saw you there. But, you know, we've got so many people moving here that it's that best place to live in America.
So here's a follow-up to that question.
So
right?
you knew about that.
Yeah, you knew about that.
Yeah, I heard about that. Thanks.
You guys have early voting here? Early voting's been
going
on?
We do have early voting.
How does that ground game play into getting people out for the vote? I mean, and the storm and all that stuff? There's a lot going on politically now in the next 6-7 days.
Which storm? The
hurricane
or the political one? Actually...
Everybody's sick and tired of the storm? Raise your hand. Sorry.
Well, the early voting has been incredibly popular. I mean, I've heard we've had an hour and a half wait some places, and it's really
early voters out there. Who's an early voter? Wow,
that's amazing!
Wow!
You know, I heard at lunch today that one of the biggest perks of voting early is that you no longer get those robocalls, right?
Yeah.
Because they can't convince you of anything anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what they should put on the commercials.
That's right.
It's true. That's selling true. Point. Well, so the unemployment rate in the state, 9.6. Here it's more around 7.
Mm-hmm.
So why start a business in Raleigh? What's your pitch?
Well, I started a business in Raleigh.
There you go.
You know, one of the there are a lot of great reasons, but one of our strengths again is education. And when you're starting a business, you have to know that you're going to be able to get that talent pool that you need to recruit to come live. I mean, to come work for you.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to have a community where people want to live.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing that we've really worked hard at, and that means investing in your parks and greenways and investing in the arts and all of those things that produce a great quality of life that make people want to live here. I mean, it's a global economy. People can live anywhere.
Yeah. You're going to run again when your term is up?
I haven't decided.
Come on, make some news. All right, there we go. Nancy McFarland, the mayor of Raleigh, North Carolina.
Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So for months, as you know, if not the last couple of years, we've been hearing about key issues like jobs and taxes and government spending. But what else is on the minds of voters, early ones or ones who vote next Tuesday? What is missing from the current political debate?
Well, our next guests have some ideas. Dave DeWitt is the Raleigh Bureau Chief and Education Reporter for WUNC. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dave, good to hear.
And Brett Chambers is a former TV producer and director who now teaches at North Carolina Central University. He's also president of the Triangle Chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists. Glad to have you both here. Thanks so much for coming.
Pleasure to be here.
Dave, let's start with you. In 2008, then-Senator Obama won North Carolina, and if he wins the state again this year, you actually say it's a victory for Republicans. Explain.
Well, I don't know that it'll be a victory for Republicans, but I think that race is really overshadowing a lot of the other races, as it does in swing states a lot. We're electing a governor, we're electing a lieutenant governor, council of state. congressmen, really all the way down the ticket, obviously, like many other states. But what's happening below the presidential race is we see that there are 13 congressional seats up for election, obviously, in North Carolina. It looks like the Republicans could win as many as 7, maybe as many as 10. And that's a major change. Republicans haven't had a majority in this state on the congressional delegation since Reconstruction. They haven't had a majority in the legislature since Reconstruction. They haven't had the governor's a governor as a Republican, all three of those, obviously, since Reconstruction. So when people wake up Wednesday morning after the election, it's highly likely that this will be as red as any state, not only in the South, but in the country. Now, obviously, there's a lot to be decided with the election, but it will be a very different state.
It is what it is, right? I mean, come on. Yeah. So, Brett, let me ask you just to turn it a little bit to issues. You used to be one of us. Now you've seen the light. You're teaching people how to be ones of us.
Yes, I am. There's one of my sons right there.
Well, that's good. That's super. Right. We'll get her later. We've heard a little bit about education in this campaign, but not a whole lot, right?
Well, one of the things is, and I agree with you, because one of the issues I had suggested was about education, but this that congressional and local legislature, all of that stuff is going to impact not just education, but the economic climate of the state and the way the state actually feels and, you know, that whole touchy-feely thing. But the other part is, I mean, you know, it's just that whole idea of education and who controls the dollars and the purse strings, but also who controls what it looks like and how it's delivered.
You know, what's really funny. What I hear you both saying is nobody's thinking big picture. Nobody's thinking big picture.
That's a good, clear statement from you, yes.
That's what I do.
Go ahead, Mark. You know, let me ask, Dave, I know that you spend a lot of time traveling the state, and I wonder what voters are saying they want to hear about, but that they're not. I was here a year ago doing a story on foreclosures. Nobody's talking about that issue. No one is talking about the coming retirement crisis. I mean, there are all these issues out there. Whatever happened to the too-big-to-fail banks? Nothing about that in the campaign. What else are people wanting to hear about?
Well, the economy, obviously, is huge, and we've been talking a little bit about the two Carolinas. It's not just rural-urban, but we've been talking about the unemployment rate being 2 points higher here than it is across the country. Well, the unemployment rate for African Americans is hovering around at 15-16% in this state, and you know, I honestly believe that if that was the overall unemployment rate in this state, we'd see rioting in the streets. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people aren't talking about how certain groups are being affected by this economy. Education has really, since the middle of the last century, lifted a lot of people out of poverty in this state, thanks to a progressive movement in the state that really started to put a lot of money into higher education in K-12. North Carolina's had a progressive streak, unlike any other state in the South. There's a good chance that will change pretty dramatically here in the next couple of
years. Yeah, Brett, go ahead.
Because one of the things I wanted to say is that whenever we talk about, you know, and we start bringing race up, we always leave out class. And you have to have class with race. Yeah. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It just, I used to work for WTVD, and we're an ABC station. That was the one thing we could coalesce all the stations around, including public broadcast, to do on race, class, and student achievement.
Right.
Because everybody started realizing, oh my God, they are actually connected. Shock.
But don't you think it's interesting? We're a little sideways here, but I'll take the host prerogative. Don't you think it's interesting that President Obama backs away consciously from the issue of race and class?
No, he doesn't. It's just that people don't listen to it the same way. And one of the things that you have somebody coming up from one of the big, strongest things North Carolina has that helps provide a safety net, not just for the African-American, but all the other people who don't have certain skills, is our community college system.
Right,
and that's something nobody talks about.
Yeah, which is coming.
Nobody talks about the community college system.
Yeah, really, really quickly, since this is ostensibly a segment about what people aren't hearing about, how many people out there, by a show of hands or applause, are voting on jobs in the economy?
Wow.
Because
that's all
really
we're talking about.
Yeah, I know.
Very interesting. How many of you want to hear more about retirement? Yeah? The banking system?
All right. You know what? That is actually revelatory. We have a minute left, Brett. You found something in the last debate that you wanted to end with that you think these guys need to talk about that nobody really is.
Okay, you're talking about the education or the
treason
part?
Well, no, it's that last bit in the debate where they were getting along and collaborating and all that stuff.
Yeah, right. Mm. Those guys. please. Because there's two things, and I'm not sure which one you're referring to. Because one, there was a conversation about taking the Department of Education and tying it to the Department of Defense and declaring education a national security issue.
Not that one so much as the leadership issue, right?
Oh, the leadership.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Go.
I gave you a bunch.
Yeah, no, that's good.
And you gave me time to do them all. So, but the leadership issue, we need somebody that's going to lead, not just by example, but lead with some clarity of thought. And we need people who are not obstructionists, because we always get caught up with the presidential part, but what about the people whose job it is to govern?
Yeah.
Right.
To govern. We need people that know how to govern. It's okay to disagree, and, you know, Jesse Helms and Ted Kennedy didn't agree on a lot of things, but when it came time to do their jobs, they did their jobs.
Preaching the choir, pal. Thanks. You're preaching the choir.
Brett Chambers, Dave DeWitt, thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much. That was awesome. Didn't mean to put you on the spot. That was perfect. It was really good. It was great. Hey, Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Interesting. So interesting you guys aren't voting on the economy. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Maybe we came to the wrong place.
All right. So we have heard that the economy is one of the biggest factors in a voter's decision, despite the show of hands that we just did not have. But what I am really curious about, who are all those people who still haven't decided who they're voting for in a little over a week? After three presidential debates, two full years of campaigning that it was arguably in your face, what possibly is left to consider?
We're actually going to find out. Olala Njenga is a small business owner here in Raleigh. She is that mythical essential element in campaigns. Although early voting started here 2 weeks ago, her 18-year-old son Justin Flowers is with her. Voted today, right?
Today.
First vote for a presidential ballot, right? Come on. Yeah. Honestly, how cool is that? I think that just rocks.
I love that. All right, so you are the key undecided voter. Everybody loves you and wants to give you presents. So you've got 8 days to make up your mind. Why are you still undecided?
Yeah, I've been getting that question a lot lately.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And how do you answer?
Gingerly. Actually, we argue about it quite a bit in the dining room.
So now wait, your son has voted, your husband has voted. Where's George, right? George, you voted?
Yes, my husband voted for the first time yesterday as a U.S. citizen.
That's great.
Oh,
really cool.
Congratulations.
Okay, so no pressure here, but how much more do you need to know?
Yeah, I've been getting that a lot. And so
you keep
that. I've been whittling it down, and Justin and I have been arguing about it quite a bit. And I guess the piece that I'm missing is that I own a strategy company, right? And I put plans together for companies all the time. And so I'm used to having to see things implemented.
Yeah.
So when I look at Romney's plan, I see the what, but I don't see the how.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. But there's more, right? So what do you hear from the Obama plan?
But when I look at Obama's plan, so I see the what and I see the how, but then it's the why, right? And so he has pieces of it that make me question, well, why? It affects me differently because our household is, I own a company and my husband is part of the workforce. He has a job. Mm-hmm. And so some of what Obama wants to do affects my family very deeply and very personally. And we have two kids in college. So it's not as easy as me just saying, oh, I'll vote Democrat or I'll vote Republican. It's very personal and very emotional.
But is it a matter of not enough information or the wrong kind of information?
It's not the right kind of information.
What are you looking for?
Yeah. What I mean, what can these campaigns do, right? I mean,
I've been getting that all day.
You keep saying that.
Okay, pretend you had both the candidates right here. You're moderating a debate right here. What do you want to know?
I would really like to understand how Romney wants to pull off 5 points in 4 years. I really need to understand that.
Remind people, 5 points of what?
Yeah, he has his five-point plan.
Right.
He can get his one-page concept or whatever. But his vision is 5 points in 4 years. Mm-hmm. And what I'm looking for is some assurance. So I guess if that were going to be the answer, it would be, can he really accomplish those 5 points in 4 years? If he can, then I'll give him a chance. I know. You can sound like my husband.
And the president?
And so yeah. My husband's point is, Olala, you don't switch horses in the middle of a race you're winning. And so he wants me to, you know, give Obama 4 more years. And so...
All right. Well, we know where this crowd is. So Justin, you voted today?
Yes, sir.
Was it hard? The decision, was it difficult?
Not really.
No, it wasn't.
So have a word with your mother, will ya?
Yeah. I'm trying to convince her to at least make a decision. I don't want to sway her one way or the other. I just want her to make a decision.
Right.
Yeah.
For me, I spend way too much of my little bit of free time doing the homework on politics and economics. So I've got all her facts, all the fact-checking she needs, but I'm still waiting for this decision.
Well, so you said that this has been a big, you know, a dinner table conversation. How do those go? You say, why are they horrible?
Oh, we go at it. We go at, because yeah. Justin does instant fact-checking. I've never seen anything like it in my whole
life. Yeah, man.
All right.
I do.
You're going to moderate in 2016. Yeah,
He's good. You know, don't let his age fool you. He's good.
This is going to be tricky because it's going to ask you to tell me how you voted. Would you be the odd person out of these two?
Actually, I'm not, because my daughter, Lindsay, is voting for the first time in an election also.
God, there's another one.
So we have 3 people in our family of 4 voting for the first time. And Lindsay has not voted. She sent me a text and wanted to know, how are you going to vote, Mom? So the boys have voted.
Tell her to mind her own beeswax, right? It's not how you vote. It's that you vote. Right?
No, I didn't.
Wow. All right. So I also got some inside information. And Justin, I think I'd like to talk with you privately after the show. I understand you gave your mom a stock tip earlier this year that netted her almost $12,000.
Yes, he did.
Yes,
nice.
The short version is that I was watching a stock for them. It was NetApp. And I had basically given them the price I thought they should buy and the price I figured they should sell. And they were taking a vacation somewhere. I forgot.
I was speaking, actually, in Dallas.
They were over there in Dallas. And I was watching it because every morning I watch it. And it happened to hit the price, so I sent her a frantic text message saying, we need to probably get on this about now.
No, it said, Mom,
do this.
Price has reached amount, sell with a question mark. And I couldn't move my thumbs fast enough.
So is this because you had done a bunch of research on the stock, I hope?
Yeah, actually, I do research
He's
on any stock
modest.
I watch. And
He's horrible. He puts the tickers on every TV. And once I tried to change the channel, and he starts screaming, the Asian markets are still open! I mean, it was horrible. Dude.
So wait.
The next close to Marketplace.
You're like, yeah, that's right. That's right. You're 18, right?
Yes, sir.
Dude, man, you got to get out. All right, Justin Flowers and his mama, Lala Njenga.
Thank you both.
Thank you guys so much. Thank you. You're great. Back, man. You're good.
So you have heard the B word in this election, the budget, and this idea that if businesses can balance a budget, why can't the federal government? Well, we are going to test that theory with Patty Hirsch and the whiteboard.
And you want to ponder the what-ifs of life, society, and science? There is no better place than right here at the Research Triangle. We'll have 2 college officials coming up to talk about the state of the economy here and what the future holds for students. That's coming up in the Marketplace, No Horse, No Race, Election Roadshow. Stick around.
Thank you for listening tonight to North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is the Marketplace No Horse, No Race Roadshow. It was recorded last night at the Rialto Theater in Raleigh by WUNC. You'll find more election coverage from North Carolina Public Radio at our website, WUNC.org. Ahead at 8 o'clock, it's a news update from NPR and The Story with Dick Gordon.
This is the Marketplace No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thanks so much for being with us, everybody.
And I'm Tess Vigeland.
This is something we have heard over and over again, ever since the financial crisis really nearly brought down the global financial system. The government should be running the economy more efficiently, more like a business. It is, of course, one of the arguments that Mr. Romney has made as part of his candidacy. He's a former business leader, governor of Massachusetts, and a CEO. Listen to this.
I'm pleased that I balance budgets. I was in the world of business for 25 years. If you didn't balance your budget, you went out of business. I went to the Olympics. That was out of balance, and we got it on balance and made a success there. I had the chance to be governor of state. 4 years in a row, Democrats and Republicans came together to balance the budget. We cut taxes 19 times, balanced our budget.
All right. So on the face of it, sounds pretty reasonable, right? I mean, any economy is all about bringing in revenue and then spending it judiciously. It is the root cause of our debate now about debt and deficit, and, of course, that fiscal cliff that we are all facing at the end of the year. But it does stand to reason that the running of an economy, that is essentially the running of a government, maybe it should be more like a business. Patty Hirsch is the brains behind our popular whiteboard explainers, and he's also the author of a new book, Man vs. Markets, Economics Explained. Welcome to the stage, Patty.
Thank you, Tennis.
Is that you? Okay.
That's me.
Is that you?
All right. That's me. That's my rendition of me.
He's a handsome chap. Huh?
Yeah.
All right. So the economy is not like a business?
Well, the economy kind of is like a business. Here's an economy I drew earlier. Hang on, let me turn the page here.
You drew the economy.
Yeah, I drew the economy. Like so that. Here we have a factory and we have the capital. And, you know, when you look at an economy and a business, initially they look kind of similar. You've got money going in the door to each of them, right? You've got money going in the mm-hmm. door of a business in the form of revenues mm-hmm. and yep. stuff that they sell. And then, of course, there's money going out in the form of wages. And there's money going into an economy in the form of taxes, because they levy taxes, and there's money going out in the form of government spending to
sure.
government spending programs.
Are these people?
These are people on the side okay. here. Yeah. These are citizens.
Just clarifying.
Citizens and workers, you see.
He's a radio guy, no drawing required.
And, you know, when times are good, of course, you've got lots of money coming in the door, so it's yeah. actually relatively easy to balance your budget. You know, yeah. of course, you've got to keep your spending under control. But, you know, you've got money coming in the door, so if there's a shortfall at this end, you can always, you know, add a little bit more at this end. So when times are good, everything's fine, you know, and the sun's up there shining away like this, smiling. But what happens when things go bad? When the storm clouds gather above the economy.
Oh, Letty.
The rain comes
a hurricane, perhaps.
Yeah, well, you see, you have a lot less money hey. Coming in here. There's a lot less coming in. Right. And you've got a lot less money coming in, you've got a problem, because you've still got the same sort of money going out.
Yeah.
All right? You've still got your spending, whether it be on government programs or whether it be on wages and all right. the rest of it. And if you're running a company, well, you've got to, you know, you're in reasonably good shape because you can just go out and sack a bunch of these people over
hey,
here.
Hey, ho, ho, ho,
no.
Hey,
no,
people,
no, 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 no.
People.
No, we've got a company to run here, okay?
You are a heartless son of a...
Well, you've got to make the decision. And, you know, maybe you have a bunch of product lines. Maybe you're selling cars and trucks. I know it looks like a sombrero, but that's a car. So... You've got your cars and your trucks, and you say, with no wheels.
He was better in rehearsal, but that's a whole different
thing. Says we're not going to sell trucks. We'll just sell cars. So we get rid of this truck here. So you just a product line. Or maybe you say, you know what? We're not going to sell cars and trucks anymore. Let's do a complete about face, and let's sell T-shirts.
Ooh.
All right? You know, if you're running a company, you can do what you want with your company. But if you're the president of a country, if you're in charge of a government, you can't just sack a bunch of these people over here. That's just not going to happen. Well, it's very, very difficult to sack wholesale vast amounts of government workers. Very, very tough to do.
Those are people's constituents, man.
The second thing you can't do is cut entire product lines. I mean, the product lines we're talking about here are the big spending programs like Social Security, like Medicare. These things are baked into the economy. They take up more than 52% of government spending, and you can't get rid of them. By law, we have to keep them.
Right.
So that leaves the sort of the discretionary stuff, you know, the non-essential stuff, you know, like defense
roads,
spending.
Yeah.
Education.
Roads,
you know?
Yeah. The Coast Guard. Yeah. Just get rid of all that stuff. So you can start to see how difficult it is if you want to start cutting. And as for changing direction, well, you can't change direction if you're running the government because you're running the government. I mean, you can't stop running the government, right? So you're a lot more restricted.
What about...
Yeah.
The folks at the top.
Yep.
Well, it seems to me that there's a big difference between the power a CEO has, where you can just basically tell anyone what you want them to do, and they're pretty much going to do it.
I'm glad you asked me this, because here's one I prepared earlier.
Oh, my.
Here's my CEO here, and here's the president here.
I like your earrings.
Yeah, his earrings are good.
Why isn't the president a woman?
That'll happen one day, maybe.
Okay. Maybe?
Maybe. So here we are, the CEO, when she walks around her pyramidal organization, can walk around and do whatever she wants, really.
Yeah.
She goes to the sales department and says, you guys in the sales department start doing this in this way. And she goes to the trading department and says, traders are going to do things this way. And you know what? They're going to do what she says because she's the boss.
Yeah.
The president walks around his pyramidal organization and goes to the, you know, the House of Representatives or the Senate and starts telling them to vote in a certain way.
Yeah. It's not going to go so well.
It's not going to go so well.
Wait, here you go.
Here's the thing. The people in the senators and House and representatives don't report to the president. They report to us. They report to the people. So if a president comes into power deciding that he's going to run or she is going to run the economy or the government like a business, she's very, very quickly going to find that she's going to run into all sorts of trouble. Why? Because you can't run. You can't take this top-down approach to running a government the way that you could a business. You've got to cajole. You've got to persuade. You've got to be diplomatic.
Charming, even.
Cheap and charming, perhaps, yes.
Oh, you rascal.
So, making that comparison, government business, not really an accurate comparison at all.
So this notion of everything changing on day one of a new president.
Ugh, you can forget that. Patty Hearst, the Marketplace Whiteboard.
So education, particularly higher education, has been tossed around by both candidates this election. And we are here in the land of 29 colleges and universities within 50 miles of this city. That's extraordinary.
But as it's great. It's great. It's great except for this. As we heard early in the show, there's also a higher than average unemployment rate here in the state of North Carolina. So what exactly is the value of a college education if you can't necessarily find a job once you've made that investment?
So joining us now are the heads of two of Raleigh's biggest public institutions. Randy Woodson is Chancellor of North Carolina State University. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And Stephen Scott is President of Wake Technical Community College. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
All right, so here is my question. What do you say to the 17-year-old, the 18-year-old, who is touring your campus, checking out the dorms, the libraries, and they're wondering, if I get this liberal arts degree, am I going to get a job with it these days?
Discuss amongst yourselves.
Well, I'm going to say that I want them to meet Justin. I've just hired him as my stockbroker.
Right? That kid? Yeah. How about that?
Manage my 401k. I have to tell you that.
That's right. Absolutely. Justin Flowers.
Because he's certainly done better than the professional management I've hired. My college doesn't do a lot of liberal arts. Okay, we have some, but basically our two middle names, technical and community, our focus is on employment. However, we send a lot of students to NC State here, and we're very proud of that fact.
So Mr. Woodson, what do you say to your students?
Well, first of all, NC State is a large technical university. Our largest single major is engineering. Over 55% of our graduates are engineers, scientists, mathematicians. So we tend to produce a very technical graduate. Now, we do liberal arts, and what I would say to folks is, if you want to produce a civil society with folks that can actually carry on a conversation and consider voting in an election like we're going on to now, we need liberal arts. Right. And we need to have a strong...
But, I think at the heart of that question, whether it's a liberal arts degree or a technical degree, that people have really started questioning even the value of a college degree because you are paying so much for it.
Well, let me start by saying that here in North Carolina, as was pointed out earlier, our citizens have committed to higher education in a way unlike most states in the country. Yes. In fact, right now, two of the largest national universities, Carolina, UNC Chapel Hill, and NC State, are considered top five buys in all of public higher education.
Okay, so let me stop you there.
All right.
Right?
Okay.
Do you want to be seen as a bargain?
Well, here's what you want to be seen as: a place that produces career-ready graduates that graduate with some of the least debt in the country.
Right.
And by the way, number one on that list is Princeton, and it's no bargain.
Yeah.
But if you think about a place like NC State and Carolina, and I know this is true for our community college system, we're low price because the citizens of North Carolina have invested heavily in higher education.
How many people? Yeah, no, which is great. And it's something this state, truly, it's something this state ought to be proud of. How many people out there are still carrying student loan debt? Not a small number.
But remember, quality is always remembered after price is forgotten.
Say that again.
Quality is always remembered after price
is
forgotten.
That's true.
And that's the point of our community colleges.
Right.
That here in North Carolina, our state has made that investment. We're the third lowest in the nation, less than $70 a credit hour.
Are you busier now? Do you have more applicants than you did before the fall of 2008?
For the past four semesters, we've had over 5,400 students on a waiting list.
Wow.
We exceeded,
they can't find places, right?
They average. Wow. They want three seats each in classes.
In classes, yeah.
And we had over 66,000 people enrolled last year.
But isn't that one of the growing issues with community colleges around the country, is that they are now a place where you can afford to go to college, and yet there are only so many of them? How do you solve that problem?
Well, about half of all freshmen now are enrolled at community colleges.
Half?
Half.
Wow.
The part that's scaring us is that more and more of our students who in the past did not take on debt are now taking on debt, but it's not for the cost of the education. It is for the living expenses that they didn't have. Even the problem with staying at home, when you're the 18-year-old, you can stay at home
right.
as long as mom and dad have a job.
Right.
But when you're the mom and dad, as right. many of our students are, and you lose your job and you want to go back and retrain, then you have to take out the loans in order to pay the rent.
Are you finding that a good chunk of your population is older adults coming back for new skills?
Of the 66,000 students, the average age is 34.
Wow.
Fascinating. Wow.
Randy, what's the biggest challenge for you in the next couple of years?
The biggest challenge, clearly, is the public debate and the public discussion about the value of higher education. Yeah. This is a country, for many years, who each generation has sought to have a higher education, a higher degree of education, than the preceding generation. Started with the GI Bill
right.
and the greatest American generation. And for the first time, we're likely to see a generation that's less educated than their parents. This does not bode well for our country. And so the greatest challenge that we have is articulating clearly and passionately why higher education is critical to keep America moving forward.
Isn't it kind of amazing that you have to make that pitch?
It is amazing.
Yeah.
We need pipes and theories that'll both hold water.
I'm sorry, one more time?
We need pipes and theories that'll both hold water.
That's right.
It seems to me that one of the questions that comes up a lot when people are talking and questioning the value of this education is they don't understand why it's become more expensive. Now, given you are both from colleges that sound like they're quite affordable, comparatively speaking, but on a nationwide basis, the cost of college has risen dramatically.
It has.
And I don't think anybody, I think a lot of people just wonder why that is. How did it get so expensive?
Well, there are a couple of real drivers. The first, of course, is higher education, public higher education, is paid for by each of the states in very, very different ways. Mm-hmm. And all of the states aren't created equal in terms of their commitment to higher education. So if you look across the country, the biggest driver for tuition increase has been decreased budgets from states.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not all. Also, we've had tremendous pressure on energy costs. We've had tremendous pressure in terms of, we're a people-intensive business. So the benefits that we have to offer all of our employers have been big drivers. But we've got to be more attentive to the cost of doing business, and we've got to be more efficient. As Kai and others pointed out earlier, we can't operate like a business, a corporate. We're more like the government than a corporation, but we do have to be more efficient. We have to use our facilities better. We've got to enroll students better in the summer. We have to make use of facilities and our people in a more efficient way.
This is the fifth one of these we've done. Education has been the hot button issue
yep.
every single time. Randy Woodson's Chancellor of NC State University. Stephen Scott at Wake Tech. Thank you so much, guys. Really appreciate you coming by. Swing that out of here. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Thanks, man.
Thank you very much. All right, well, we are coming to you from the Rialto Theater in the Five Points area of Raleigh. To his neighbors, Scott Hewler is the unofficial mayor here. His most recent book, On the Grid, is an exercise in, shall we call it, what, hyper-localism.
Hyper-localism, yeah. So we've got maybe 2.5-3 minutes left by the clock over there. We wanted to get back where we started before the boys back here play us out. We're going to get back to the things that really matter, the stuff that is going to count even after this election is over. So, Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi. When I moved here 20 years ago, almost exactly, Raleigh suddenly started appearing on all those top 10 lists. So I naturally thought that probably the secret ingredient was me. I have learned since that actually it's not, and I think that the secret ingredient here is compromise, and I'd like to explain that by using the Wake County School Board. My son goes to a wonderful school.
It's a hot button issue, I guess.
That he gets to by bus, even though he could walk to two schools closer by. But I'm like, that's good. It diversifies the schools. That's important. I'm for that. System's a national model. I'll compromise. As you know, in 2009, we elected some Republicans to the school board, and they didn't like all that busing. Economic diversity was not as important as community. So they started to plan for neighborhood schools, which would have sent my son to a high school miles away instead of the one he could walk to, thus building community in my neighborhood. Didn't go over well. Democrats and Republicans eventually compromised on a choice plan that buses pretty much every single kid to every single school all at the same time. It costs more, so they compromised by selling buses. Some students were not even assigned to schools, which demonstrated choice by encouraging parents to use choice words. Two of the board members who may or may not have been having an affair got into a mix-up over $130,000. One of them kept in a backpack in her home. That seems more like compromising than compromise to me, but it seems germane. Since we got into this mess by failing to pass school bonds a decade ago, the county commission has punished the school board for bad behavior by refusing to put a school bond on the ballot. That's the same county commission, by the way, that responded to $40 million in grants for a new downtown rail station by refusing to put a transportation tax on the ballot. Thus, we'll build the station, we won't have the trains. That's compromise, Wake County style. I've been here for 20 years. I still don't know why we're on all those lists, but we could discuss it, and I'm sure we can compromise.
We called him Scott Hewler, ladies and gentlemen. His book is called On the Grid. Tell you what, the truth is, Scott, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. We called him 2 hours ago and said, listen, we need to kill 3 minutes at the end of the show. Can you do something? So he did that. How about that? Hit it, fellas.
All right, and that is the Marketplace No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow. Devin Maverick Robbins produced our program. Nancy Fargali is the Roadshow Executive Producer. Our engineer is Jeff Peters.
Special thanks today, obviously, to David Brower and the entire WUNC staff. Also, the Rialto Theater for hosting us. This is the biggest crowd we've had, by the way, the whole time. Yeah, how about that? How about that? 400 people. The executive producer of Marketplace is Deborah Clark. J.J. Orr is the vice president and general manager. Everything you heard tonight you can find and more on our website. It's called marketplace.org. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Chess Bigland. Thanks for being here. Have a great night.
Hit it. I'm serious about that Garrison Keillor thing, by the way. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.